The Hindenburg disaster occurred on May 6, 1937, in Manchester Township, New Jersey. The German passenger airship LZ-129 Hindenburg caught fire and was destroyed during its attempts to dock with its mooring mast at Naval Air Station Lakehurst. 35 fatalities in total. But how did such a horrible disaster occur? That's what we discuss today on The Dark Side of Wikipedia.
Sometimes the human mind goes to dark places. Sometimes those dark delusions turn into a reality. A reality so shaded and gray, once all is said and done, the healthy mind is drawn into the documented retelling of these tragic events, trying to find logic, reason, and understanding where there may be none at all. This is The Dark Side of Wikipedia.
The Hindenburg disaster was the subject of newsreel coverage, photographs, and Herbert Morrison's recorded radio eyewitness reports from the landing field, which were broadcast the next day. A variety of hypotheses have been put forward for both the cause of ignition and the initial fuel for the ensuing fire. The event shattered public confidence in the giant passenger-carrying rigid airship and marked the abrupt end of the airship era. After opening its 1937 season by completing a single round-trip passage to Rio de Janeiro, Brazil in late March, the Hindenburg departed from Frankfurt, Germany on the evening of May 3rd, on the first of 10 round-trips between Europe and the United States that were scheduled for its second year of commercial service. American Airlines had contracted with the operators of the Hindenburg to shuttle the passengers from Lakehurst to Newark for connections to airplane flights. Except for strong headwinds which slowed its progress, the Atlantic crossing of the Hindenburg was otherwise unremarkable until the airship attempted an early evening landing at Lakehurst 3 days later, on May 6. Although carrying only half its full capacity of passengers, 36 of 70 and crewmen, 61 including 21 crewmen trainees, during the flight accident, the Hindenburg was fully booked for its return flight. Many of the passengers with tickets to Germany were planning to attend the coronation of King George VI and Queen Elizabeth in London the following week. The airship was hours behind schedule when it passed over Boston on the morning of May 6, and its landing at Lakehurst was expected to be further delayed because of afternoon thunderstorms. Advised of the poor weather conditions at Lakehurst, Captain Max Preuss charted a course over Manhattan Island, causing a public spectacle as people rushed out to the street to catch a sight of the airship. After passing over the field at 4 p.m., Captain Preuss took passengers on a tour over the seasides of New Jersey while waiting for the weather to clear. After finally being notified at 6:22 p.m. that the storms had passed, Preuss directed the airship back to Lakehurst to make its landing almost a half day late. This would have much less time than anticipated to service and prepare the airship for its scheduled departure back to Europe. The public was informed that they would not be permitted at the mooring location or be able to visit abroad the Hindenburg during its stay at port. Around 7 p.m. local time at an altitude of 650 feet, the Hindenburg made its final approach to the Lakehurst Naval Air Station. This was to be a high landing, known as a flying moor because the airship would drop its landing ropes and mooring cable at a high altitude and then be winched down to the mooring mast. This type of landing maneuver would reduce the number of ground crewmen, but would require more time. Although the high landing was a common procedure for American airships, the Hindenburg had only performed this maneuver a few times in 1936 while landing in Lakehurst. At 7:09 p.m., the airship made a sharp full-speed left turn to the west around the landing field because the ground crew was not ready. At 7:11 p.m., it turned back towards the landing field and valved gas. All engines idled ahead, and the airship began to slow. Captain Preuss ordered aft engines full astern at 7:14 p.m., while at an altitude of 394 feet to try to brake the airship. At 7:17 p.m., the wind shifted direction from east to southwest, and Captain Preuss ordered a second sharp turn starboard, making an S-shaped flight path towards the mooring mast. At 7:18 p.m., as the final turn progressed, Preuss ordered 300 and 500 kilograms of water ballast into successive drops because the airship was stern-heavy. The forward gas cells were also valved. As these measures failed to bring the ship in trim, 6 men, 3 of whom were killed in the accident, were then sent to bow the trim of the airship. At 7:21 p.m., while the Hindenburg was at an altitude of 290 feet, the mooring lines were dropped from the bow, and starboard line was dropped first, followed by the port line. The first port line was over-tightened as it was connected to the post of the ground winch. The starboard line had still not been connected. A light rain began to fall as the ground crew grabbed the mooring lines. At 7:25 p.m., a few witnesses saw the fabric ahead of the upper fin fluttered, as if gas were leaking. Others reported seeing a dim blue flame, possibly static electricity or St. Elmo's fire. Moments before the fire on top and in the back of the ship near the point where the flames first appeared, several other eyewitness testimonies suggested that the first flame appeared on the port side just ahead of the port fin and was followed by flames which burned on top. Commander Rosendahl testified to the flames in front of the upper fin being mushroom-shaped. One witness on the starboard side reported a fire beginning lower and behind the rudder on the side. On board, people heard a muffled detonation, and those in the front of the ship felt a shock as the port trail rope over-tightened, and officers in the control car initially thought the shock was caused by a broken rope. At 7:25 p.m. local time, the Hindenburg caught fire and quickly became engulfed in flames. It's the dark side of Wikipedia, everybody. Welcome to the program. If you like the show, press subscribe wherever you download podcasts. And if you want to support the program and help keep this thing alive and become a Darksider, get access to our final chapters. Just search Dark Side of Wikipedia on Patreon or go to our website, darksideofwiki.com, and click Become a Darksider. $5 a month gets you access to all of our advanced episodes, as well as our final chapter segments of the program. Tony and Sean today talking to you about the Hindenburg. And this is one of those things that, you know, we've seen the footage, we've seen or heard the radio reports and all that in history books. But, you know, I didn't honestly know a whole lot about it other than a blimp caught fire and a lot of people died. Logistics and all that. I had no idea the thing traveled over the ocean. I had no idea they went that far. What's been your knowledge on this?
Your knowledge is my knowledge. I remember large blimp, fire, boom, people died. End of story. Yeah. I had no idea that this was, I would suspect, growing up, I can remember, everybody knows the Goodyear blimp. And I can remember when it would come to visit races and larger events, you see a blimp, you can't just land it like an airplane. I mean, you can't, once it's on the ground and you press the brakes, but there's so much going into a landing and gases and combined with other flammable entities. I did not know all of this was going on that led to this ultimate disaster.
I had no idea either. It's one of those things where it's, again, you just kind of see the little snippets of history, but there's not a lot of context to it. I always kind of wondered, you know, like why, you know, obviously, you know, this thing went up in flames, but I would think there's airplanes that obviously have a lot of issues too, but they don't just like stop air travel in terms of airplanes. They find ways of perfecting it. So I guess I'm wondering why was this sort of travel never perfected or brought back into some sort of service other than, you know, like the Goodyear blimp that flies over football games? Is it the efficiency of it? Is there an inherent danger of mass people traveling on these things? I guess maybe we'll learn more about that as we dive into the story. But I've never seen a blimp take off. I think I've seen them in the air before once or twice in my life, but that's about it.
My prediction is a blimp has far less controllable parts of it. I mean, it's a blimp. It's a large balloon, and then you have a little basket of sorts below it where the passengers are, opposed to an airplane that is more of an actual metal steel structure that you can design as such and update technology, where a blimp's a blimp. There's only so much that you can modernize, and maybe that is, again, I don't know either, but that maybe that's why there are far less that actually transport people opposed to being a big old billboard in the sky.
It's kind of one of those things I'm surprised we've never had an offer to go on, just, you know, from working in media, because we typically, when there's something around in your city or whatnot, you'll get, hey, let's have the local DJs go and, you know, go on it, like for airplanes and stuff like that.
Never big enough. Never been
offered a blimp ride. I don't know that they do that, though. I don't know how many people even travel like in the Goodyear blimp or how that works.
I'd do it. Would you?
I think I probably would, because you never hear like the Goodyear blimp going down. I would think they maybe have this perfected better, or have more blimps gone down since this.
Let's continue on, and I think I'm going to Google recent blimps going down.
Okay. Let's continue into that. As we share more of the story of the Hindenburg disaster here on the Dark Side of Wikipedia. Eyewitness statements disagree as to where the fire initially broke out. Several witnesses on the port side saw yellow-red flames first jump forward on the top fin near the ventilation shaft of cells 4 and 5. Other witnesses on the port side noted the fire actually began just ahead of the horizontal port fin, only then followed by flames in front of the upper fin. One with views of the starboard side saw flames beginning lower and further aft near cell 1, behind the rudders inside the airship. Helmsman Helmut Lau was stationed in the lower fin, testified to hearing a muffled detonation and looked up to see a bright reflection of the front bulkhead of gas cell number 4, which suddenly disappeared by the heat. As other gas cells started to catch fire, the fire spread more to the starboard side and the ship dropped rapidly. Although there were cameramen from 4 newsreel teams and at least one spectator known to be filming the landing, as well as numerous photographers at the scene, no known footage or photograph exists of the moment the fire started. Wherever the flames started, they quickly spread forward first, consuming cells 1 to 9 in the rear end of the structure, imploded almost instantly. 2 tanks, it is disputed whether they contained water or fuel, burst out of the hull as a result of the shock of the blast. Buoyancy was lost on the stern of the ship, and the bow lurched upward while the ship's back broke. The falling stern stayed in trim. As the tail of the Hindenburg crashed into the ground, a burst of flame came out of the nose, killing 9 of the 12 crew members on the bow. There was still gas in the bow section of the ship, so it continued to point upward as the stern collapsed down. The cell behind the passenger decks ignited as the side collapsed inward, and the scarlet lettering reading Hindenburg was erased by flames as the bow descended. The airship's gondola wheel touched the ground, causing the bow to bounce up slightly as one final gas cell burned away. At this point, most of the fabric on the hull had also burned away, and the bow finally crashed to the ground. Although the hydrogen had finished burning, the Hindenburg's diesel fuel burned for several more hours. The time that it took for the first signs of disaster to the bow crashing to the ground is often reported as 32, 34, or 37 seconds. Since none of the newsreel cameras were filming the airship when the fire first started, the time of the start can only be estimated from various eyewitness accounts and the duration of the longest footage of the crash. One careful analysis by NASA's Addison Bain gives the flame front spread rate across the fabric skin as about 49 feet a second at some points during the crash, which would have resulted in a total destruction time of about 16 seconds. Some of the derailleum framework of the airship was salvaged by and shipped back to Germany, where it was recycled and used in the construction of military aircraft for the Luftwaffe, as were the frames of the LZ-127 Graf Zeppelin and the LZ-130 Graf Zeppelin II, when both were scrapped in 1940. In the days after the disaster, an official board of inquiry was set up at Lakehurst to investigate the cause of the fire. The investigation by the U.S. Commerce Department was headed by Colonel South Trimble Jr., while Dr. Hugo Eckner led the German commission. The disaster was well documented. Heavy publicity about the first transatlantic passenger flight of the year by a Zeppelin to the United States had attracted a large number of journalists to the landing. Thus, many news crews were on site at the time of the airship exploding. And so there was a significant amount of newsreel coverage and photographs, as well as Herbert Morrison's eyewitness reports for radio station WLS in Chicago, a report which was broadcast the next day. Parts of Morrison's broadcast were later dubbed onto newsreel footage that gave the impression that the words and film were recorded together, but that was not the case. The newsreel footage was shot by 4 newsreel cameraman teams, Path News, Movie Tone News, Hearst News of the Day, and Paramount News. Al Gold of Fox Movie Tone News later received a presidential citation for his work, one of the most widely circulated photographs of the disaster. Showing the airship crashing with the mooring mast in the foreground was photographed by Sam Scher of International News Photos. When the fire started, he did not have time to put the camera to his eye and shot the photo from the hip. Murray Becker of the Associated Press photographs the fire engulfing the airship while it was still on even keel using his 4x5 speed graphic camera. His next photograph shows flames bursting out of the nose of the bow, telescoped upwards. In addition to professional photographers, spectators also photographed the crash. They were stationed in the spectators area near Hangar No. 1 and had a side rear view of the airship. Customs broker Arthur Coford Jr. and 16-year-old Fu Chu both had Leica cameras with high-speed film, allowing them to take a larger number of photographs than the press photographers. None of Coford's photographs were printed in Life magazine, while Chu's photographs were shown in the New York Daily News. The newsreels and photographs, along with Morrison's passionate reporting, shattered public and industry faith in the airships and marked the end of the giant airship passenger carrying ships. Also contributing to the downfall of the Zeppelin was the arrival of international passenger air travel and Pan American Airlines. Heavier-than-air aircraft regularly crossed the Atlantic and Pacific much faster than the 130 kilometer per hour airships speed of the Hindenburg. The one advantage that the Hindenburg had over such aircraft was a comfort that she afforded her passengers. So there you go. It's an efficiency thing as to why they stopped. And I would imagine a little bit of public perception, too, after, like, the first transatlantic airship goes into flames and everyone watches it burn.
There's always PR, even back then. To have, okay, what are the optics of this? How does this look? I know we see a fireball in the sky, but focus your attention over here.
Yeah, I think that's what they were trying to do. It's just kind of, can you imagine being someone in the crowd when you're sitting there? I suppose it's kind of, The only other thing I can think of where there's a crowd gathering and they literally were expecting one thing and got the opposite would have been like watching the Challenger take off. And just this horrific feeling of watching your loved ones. Because imagine some people there, you know, they had loved ones that were waiting and they were, you know, going to land. And guess what? You get to watch them die. I mean, just God, I don't know how you process that or move on from that sort of trauma. That to me, I mean, it's horrific enough to know that a loved one has died of just natural causes. It's worse if it's something that was preventable. It's a whole other thing where it's something that was likely preventable, but you got to watch it happen in real time.
Do you ever have a dream or you're waking up and you feel like you can't move your limbs?
Are you talking like sleep paralysis?
Yes.
I have had that one time.
A similar feeling, I would presume, if I am watching this blimp coming to land, it starts fire, starts on fire, and then what I see, I would feel very similar. I'd feel so helpless, where I would want to go. I would want to, I don't know, I mean, you can't find a fire extinguisher big enough at this point to assist, but yeah. Man, and to have those mental images burned into my brain every time I would close my eyes or try to fall asleep months, years after that, it'd be a tough stretch having to go through that.
It would. I mean, it's just something that I can't fathom being in that situation. The thing is, when you hear about disasters like this that are just so horrific, a lot of times it really kind of does burn you to be like, there's no way I'd go on that. But I don't know, because this happened so long ago, I would consider going up in a blimp. You know, we just talked about that, but I would. But with air travel too, I still fly, but I do have hesitation about flying, even though I know it's inherently safer than getting out there on the highway. My odds of getting in a car accident are far greater than dying in an airplane crash, but I guess it's just the magnitude of the disaster. It's I guess, kind of like the cable news effect, if you will. Things can appear so much worse and scary when it's, you know, repeated to you over and over in very dramatic fashion. But when you don't take it into context of looking at statistics and odds, and then when you do that, you kind of play your, I can live by odds once I can absorb that. But I think that's something that a lot of people don't do or can't do. They base it more on emotion and fear rather than facts and data.
You have to imagine at any given time, there's what, 50,000 airplanes in the sky right now at this very moment. And we find out of accidents so far and few between. I would imagine that there's a certain amount of blimps as well. So yes, absolutely. Only what is known or top of mind or making even worse, not to say that tragic events, news outlets make them even worse than they appear, but in some cases they will exaggerate a bit. And sure. Then it just, we still can remember Air France from what was that, 20, almost 30 years ago. Yeah. And that was one plane crash when millions have flown just okay. So you can't, again, everybody has a personal view on how they want to do, but you can't then live the rest of your life in fear and not do something that was a part of your life because one accident occurred in so many.
Here's one that we should probably do on the show sometime. I mean, you brought up Air France, and we're not talking about the Concorde. The Concorde is another one. That's one where that form of flight did end after the Concorde exploded in midair. They stopped flying those. Now there's talk again of trying to bring a new version of the Concorde back, or some new, you know, speed of sound travel. But it really hasn't, you know, come to fruition as of yet. But that was something where it was an air travel thing. It was different than an airplane, similar to an airplane because it goes in the sky just like a blimp, but nothing else could go that fast in terms of commercial travel other than military travel. But that was one where it happened and boom, everybody said no more Concorde, even though these things had so many safe flights. So I wonder, that's one to look into more. That'd be one to talk about, is to learn to why they decided to ground all of them after the one disaster, after so many successes with that plane. Why did the one make them all go, oh shit, this could happen to any of them at any point in time? I don't know the answer to that.
I would imagine the pros definitely outweighed the cons. It's one accident. I mean, you could get international travel in like an hour, 2 hours, I want to say.
It was a couple hours. It was like 2 or 3 hours to get across continents. Wow. And it was a big thing. I mean, it was normal. I mean, I think when we were kids, you know, the Concorde was a thing. I never traveled on it. I mean, it was ridiculously expensive. So it was like travel of the rich. Or business travel and things of that. But the thing is, I think we all kind of thought the future was going to be the Concordes, and they were going to like there's a handful of them at the time. But I think we all kind of thought this is going to be the future. All planes are going to be like the Concorde someday. Nope. The exact opposite happened. We went back to slower air travel, actually, than we did faster air travel, and because of safety reasons. So it's kind of funny. Sometimes the future type things, they get out there for a little bit and then we realize this was a bad idea. But that'd be a good one to do on the show. Let's continue into the story of the Hindenburg and learn more about what happened with this tragic tale. In contrast to the media coverage of the United States, media coverage of the disaster in Germany was more subdued. Although some photographs of the disaster were published in newspapers, the newsreel footage was not released until after World War II. Additionally, German victims were memorialized in a similar manner to fallen war heroes, and grassroots movements to fund Zeppelin construction were expressly forbidden by the Nazi government. There have been a series of other airship accidents prior to the Hindenburg fire. Many were caused by bad weather. The Graf Zeppelin had flown safely for more than 1.6 million kilometers, including the first of the globe by an airship. The Zeppelin company's promotions had prominently featured the fact that no passenger had been injured on any of its airships. 13 of the 36 passengers died and 22 of the 61 crew died. Most survivors were severely burned. Also killed was one ground crewman, the civilian linesman Alan Hagerman. 10 passengers and 16 crewmen died in the crash or the fire. The majority of the victims were burnt to death, while others died jumping from the airship at an excessive height or as a consequence of smoke inhalation or falling debris. 6 other crew members, 3 passengers, and Alan Hageman died in the following hours or days, mostly as a result of burns. The majority of the crewmen who died were up inside the ship's hull. They were either did not have a clear escape route or were close to the bow of the ship, which hung burning in the air for too long for most of them to escape death. Most of the crew in the bow died in the fire, although at least one was filmed falling from the bow to his death. Most of the passengers who died were trapped in the starboard side of the passenger deck. Not only was the wind blowing the fire towards the starboard side, but the ship also rolled slightly to starboard as it settled to the ground, with much of the upper hull on that part of the ship collapsing outboard of the starboard observation windows, thus cutting off the escape of many of the passengers on that side. To make matters worse, the sliding door leading from the starboard passenger area to the central foyer and the gangway stairs, through which rescuers led a number of passengers to safety, jammed shut during the crash, further trapping those passengers on the starboard side. Nonetheless, some did manage to escape from the starboard passenger decks. By contrast, all but a few of the passengers on the port side of the ship survived the fire, with some of them escaping virtually unscathed. Although the best-remembered airship disaster was not the worst. Just over twice as many, 73 of 76 on board, had perished when the helium-filled U.S. Navy scout ship USS Akron crashed at sea off of New Jersey coast 4 years earlier, on April 4th, 1933. Warner France, the 14-year-old cabin boy, was initially dazed on realizing the ship was on fire, but when a water tank above him burst open, putting out the fire around him, he was spurred to action. He made his way to the nearby hatch and dropped through it just as the forward part of the ship was briefly rebounding into the air. He began to run towards the starboard side, but stopped and turned around and ran to the other way because the wind was pushing the flames in that direction. He escaped without injury and was the last surviving crew member when he died in 2014. The last survivor, Werner G. Donner, died November 8, 2019. At the time of the disaster, Donner was 8 years old and vacationing with his family. He recalled later that his mother threw him and his brother out of the ship and jumped after them. They survived, but Donner's father and sister were killed. When the coroner car crashed on the ground, or rather when the control car crashed on the ground, most of the officers leapt through the windows but became separated. First Officer Captain Albert Samet found Captain Max Proust trying to re-enter the wreckage to look for survivors. Proust's face was badly burned and he required months of hospitalization and reconstructive surgery, but he survived. Captain Ernest Lehman escaped the crash with burns to his head and arms and severe burns across most of his back. He died at a nearby hospital the next day. When passenger Joseph Spash, a vaudeville comic acrobat, saw the first sign of trouble, he smashed the window with his movie camera, which he had been filming, the landing. The film survived the disaster. As the ship neared the ground, he lowered himself out of the window and hung onto the window ledge, letting go when the ship was perhaps 20 feet above the ground. His acrobat's instincts kicked in, and Spash kept his feet under him and attempted to do a safety roll when he landed. He injured his ankle nonetheless and was dazed, crawling away when a member of the ground crew came to help, slung him under his arm, and ran him clear of the fire. Of the 12 crewmen in the bow of the airship, only 3 survived. 4 of these 12 men were standing on the mooring shelf, a platform up at the very tip of the bow from which the forwardmost landing ropes and the steel mooring cable were released to the ground crew, which was directly at the forward and end of the axle walkway and just ahead of gas cell number 16. The rest were standing either along the lower keel walkway ahead of the control car or else on platforms beside the stairway leading up the curve of the bow to the mooring shelf. During the fire, the bow hung in the air at roughly a 45-degree angle, and flames shot forward through the axle walkway, bursting through the bow. The bow gas cells like a blowtorch. The 3 men found the forward section, who survived. Elevator man Kurt Bauer took Alfred Grollinger and electrician Joseph Liebrecht were those furthest aft the bow, and 2 of them happened to be standing near 2 large triangular air vents through which cool air was being drawn by the fire. Neither of these men sustained more than superficial burns. Most of the men standing along the bow stairway either fell aft into the fire or tried to leap from the ship when it was still too high in the air. 3 of the 4 men standing on the mooring shelf inside the very tip of the bow were actually taken from the wreck alive, though one died shortly afterward in the air station's infirmary, and the other two were reported by newspapers to have initially survived the fire and then to subsequently have died at the area hospitals during the night or early the following morning. Hydrogen fires are less destructive to immediate surroundings than gasoline explosions because of the buoyancy of H2, which causes heat of combustion to be released upwards more than other ways as leaked mass ascends into the atmosphere. Hydrogen fires are more survivable than fires of gasoline or wood. The hydrogen in the Hindenburg burned out within about 90 seconds. At the time of the disaster, sabotage was commonly put forward as the cause of the fire, initially by Hugo Eckner, former head of the Zeppelin Company, and the old man of German airships. In initial reports before inspecting the accident, Eckner mentioned the possibility of a shot as the cause of the disaster because of threatening letters that had been received, but did not rule out other causes. Eckner later publicly endorsed the static spark hypothesis. At the time, on a lecture tour in Austria, he was awakened at about 2:30 in the morning by the ringing of his bedside telephone. It was a Berlin representative of the New York Times with news that the Hindenburg exploded yesterday evening at 7 p.m. above the airfield at Lakehurst. By the time he left the hotel the next morning to travel to Berlin for a briefing on the disaster, the only answer that he had for the reports waiting outside to question him was that based on what he knew, the Hindenburg had exploded over the airfield. Sabotage might be a possibility. However, he learned more about the disaster, particularly that the airship had burned rather than actually exploded. He grew more and more convinced that static discharge rather than sabotage was the cause. Commander Charles Rosenthal, commander of the Naval Air Station at Lakehurst, and the man in the overall charge of the ground-based portion of the Hindenburg landing maneuver, also came to believe that the Hindenburg had been sabotaged. He laid out a general cause for sabotage in his book, What About the Airship?, which was as much an extended argument for the further development of the rigid airship as it was a historical overview of the airship concept. Another proponent of sabotage hypothesis was Max Preuss, commander of the Hindenburg throughout the airship's career. Preuss flew on nearly every flight of the Graf Zeppelin until the Hindenburg was ready. In a 1960 interview conducted by Kenneth Lisch for Columbia University's Oral History Research Office, Preuss said early dirigible travel was safe, and therefore he strongly believed that sabotage was to blame. He stated that on trips to South America, which was a popular destination for German tourists, both airships passed through thunderstorms and were struck by lightning but remained unharmed. Most members of the crew refused to believe that one of them could commit an act of sabotage, insisting only a passenger could have destroyed the airship. The suspect favored by Commander Rosenthal, Captain Preuss, and others among the Hindenburg's crew was passenger Joseph Spa, a German acrobat who survived the fire. He brought with him a dog, a German shepherd named Ulla, as a surprise for his children. He reportedly made a number of unaccompanied visits to feed his dog, who was being kept in a freight room near the stern of the ship. Those who suspected Spa based their suspicions primarily on those trips into the ship's interior to feed his dog, that according to some of the stewards, Spa had told anti-Nazi jokes during the flight. Recollections by steward that Spa had seemed agitated by the repeated delays in landing, and that he was an acrobat who could conceivably climb into the airship's rigging to plant a bomb. In 1962, A.A. Holling published Who Destroyed the Hindenburg, in which he rejects all theories but sabotage and named a crew member as a suspect. Eric Spell, a rigger in the Hindenburg who died in the fire, was named as a potential saboteur. 10 years later, Michael McDonald Mooney's book, The Hindenburg, which was based heavily on Holding's sabotage hypothesis, also identified Spiel as a possible saboteur. Mooney's book was made into the movie The Hindenburg in 1975. Producers of the film were sued by Holling for plagiarism, but Holling's case was dismissed because he had presented his sabotage hypothesis as historical fact, and it is not possible to claim ownership of historical facts. Holling claimed the following, in the naming Spiel as a culprit. Spiel's girlfriend had communist beliefs and anti-Nazi connections. The fire's origin was near the catwalk running through gas cell 4, which was an area of the ship generally off-limits to anyone other than Spiel and his fellow riggers. Holling's claim that chief steward Heinrich Kubis told him the chief rigger Ludwig Kohr noticed damage of cell 4 shortly before the disaster. Rumors that Gestapo had investigated Spiel's possible involvement in 1938. Spiel's interest in amateur photography making him familiar with flashbulbs that could have served as an igniter. He discovered by representatives of the New York Police Department bomb squad of a substance that was later determined to likely be an insoluble residue from the depolarizing element of a small dry battery. A discovery by Federal Bureau of Investigation agents of a yellow substance on the valve cap of the airship between cells 4 and 5 where the fire was first reported. Although initially suspected to be sulfur, which can ignite hydrogen, it was later determined that the residue was actually from a fire extinguisher. A flash or bright reflection in gas cell 4 that crew members near the lower fin had seen just before the fire. Holling's and later Mooney's hypothesis goes on to say that it's unlikely that Spiel wanted to kill people, that he intended the airship to burn after the landing. However, with the ship already over 12 hours late, Spiel was unable to find an excuse to reset the timer on his bomb. It had been suggested that Adolf Hitler himself ordered the Hindenburg to be destroyed in retaliation for Eckner's anti-Nazi opinions. Since the publication of Holling's book, most airship historians, including Dr. Douglas Robinson, have dismissed Holling's sabotage hypothesis because no solid evidence was ever presented to support it. No pieces of a bomb were ever discovered, and there's no evidence in existing documents that the sample collected from the wreckage and determined to be residue from a dry cell battery was found anywhere near the stern of the airship. And on closer examination, the evidence against Spiel and his girlfriend turned out to be rather weak. Additionally, it's unlikely that Rigor Corps would not remain at Cell 4 to further assess the purported damage claimed by Kubis. In an interview with the TV show Secrets and Mysteries, Holling himself asserted it was only his theory and suggested a short circuit could be another potential cause of the fire. So lots of people trying to find blame, which is normal. You'd want to find the cause or blame or whatever you want to call it in such a disaster. And with everything going on in the world at that time with World War II, it would be, I guess, likely to suspect, is this some sort of what we would call today terrorism?
Sure didn't know Hitler possibly ordered it to be destroyed. My goodness, that is definitely an attention grabber.
Well, I mean, it makes sense that people would be thinking about those sort of things. We do have direct correlation as to what it feels like to be in a world where everything that happens that's negative for the next many years or during a wartime, the suspicions pop in of, was this terrorist related after 9/11. Almost anything that happened that was a tragedy, the first thing that popped into everyone's mind was possible terror relations to it. Do you remember right after, it was several months, I'd say about probably 4 or 5 months after 9/11, there was a plane that crashed into a neighborhood, I believe it was in New York City. It turned out there was something wrong with the plane. It was not terrorist related, but everyone that morning when that happened was fearing, oh my God. I think we went into breaking news coverage nonstop and everything just went to, oh my God, is this happening again?
I do. And I think that it is as much as news can be outlandish. And if it bleeds, it leads. I think all of us were in a state of, holy shit, this is just continuing. So I very much do. And it was very comforting to realize, well, not if you have a family member that got hurt there, but that it was just an accident per se. But what I think is interesting in going back and reliving these historical events that maybe some of us learned in social studies growing up is current day, we truly understand even ourselves, the conspiracy theories and based upon all of our opinions, what is reported as this, we really think is that. Historical events, all too often, or at least for me, I never really even thought of, well, there was probably just as much conspiracy theories back then than there is for us now. Mm-hmm. So it's very interesting to go back and to do a deep dive and then say, oh, well, it wasn't just this or this. It was one of 9 different possibilities. And here is pretty darn near good cases that would validate why this is what truly may have happened or why this occurred, which is kind of terrifying when you think about it.
This is an interesting question to think about. Were conspiracy theories more dangerous back then, or are they more dangerous now? And here's why. Back then, if you have a conspiracy theory, it's going to be discussed amongst people. You know, I heard this, and I heard somebody told me that. And, oh, really? And you have no real way other than picking up a newspaper or something to factually base what you're talking about on. And newspapers aren't going to necessarily be reporting fringe conspiracy ideas. They're going to report more factual type data. Today, so that stuff can just spread like wildfire, and it's all based on he said, she said, and pass from town to town to town to town. Today, those sort of things still happen, but we have the ability to fact check things like no other. Yet it seems like conspiracy theories that can be easily debunked without a doubt, not like, oh, well, there's some question and that's what I believe. No, look, here is the fact that debunks exactly what you said. And there's no arguing it, because here, you said the sky is blue, is purple, but I'm showing you at this point in time on this date, at this shot, it's blue. See, it's just a timestamp on this picture. There's data there that you can in. There's 1,000 pictures of the sky at this time. It's all blue. None of it's purple. I still believe it's purple. What is that? Where we can now debunk things like no other. And still, conspiracy theories thrive in ways that they never even did before. They can spread faster, but we can debunk them quicker, too. And it's one thing when there's information out there that is questionable and that can feed into conspiracy theories. I get that. When you don't have compelling evidence either way, yeah, you're going to get that stuff that flows. But when it's just there, there's a can of soda on my desk. No, there isn't. Yes, it's a Pepsi can. It's right here. I don't see it. It's right there. I don't believe it's there. That's the world we live in today. And I think back then, if you had somebody doing that sort of thing, they'd look at you like you were fucking insane. Like, well, I thought there was no soda can there, but I'm here now. I see it. I believe it's there. Today it's, I don't believe it's there. You're touching the can. There's nothing in my hand. What the fuck is that?
I think as much as the debunk ability has grown exponentially from 1937 when the Hindenburg, this occurred, to 2021, that has grown tremendously. I also think the confidence for one person, even though I'm holding a soda can in my hand to say, there's no can. Mm-hmm. The confidence to be utterly stupid is not the correct word, but the confidence to just...
Incompetent.
Sure. The confidence to basically go against what is essentially fact just because you want to make up your own and just because you want to align your truth within your little bubble. Because sadly, with everything growing and everybody having an opinion and social media and the internet and everybody having... everybody having their own little Rubik's cubes, and they can customize it however they want to show, see, this is how it looks. Well, no, this is how it is, but this is how it looks. So I think there's no true answer. But if the one you did ask, as far as conspiracy theory, where is there more validity to it? I think back then, because people would just have to kind of go with it, and there was no recant or retort. Well, no, I don't believe you because X, Y, Z. Well, but I'm just giving you all of the factual evidence to see it this way and not mm-hmm. this way. Well, I'm not going to see it that way. Current day, you know, as much as there is that much more proof, there is that much more, you said incompetency, and I'll go with that, to combat the truth. Whereas back then, it was just, I think, more strength in numbers. And if 20 people saw it one way and there was one person, they would more so align to that other 20 opposed to just being a naive, incompetent human and not believing.
But I think what we see today is a strength in numbers thing. There is confidence in incompetency, and that's the problem. People will do that. They may be holding that hand. They may, that soda can in their hand, they may for a moment realize they're holding the soda can in their hand, but then their 20 Facebook friends all say, there's no soda can in your hand. And then suddenly they have this confidence in incompetency, and then incompetency rules. Like, maybe I don't, You're right, I don't. It's not there. And they almost start to believe this incompetent delusion. But I mean, and that's where I'm so mystified at so much of this, because it's like, how do you not, there's part of you that's got to know you're wrong, or got to know that what you're saying is at the very least questionable. And the confidence that people have in incompetency is, I think, the scary part. Because there used to be at least a bit of reason going, yeah, it's a soda can, but you said it was Pepsi, it's 7-Up. You know, there would be like a slight variation. You know, it's not soda, it's pop. It's a pop can in my hand. Now it's just like, there's no can in my hand. No, there clearly is. It's not a can, it's a container of aluminum. It's like, what the fuck are you talking about? And then we start arguing logistics, and they still can never quite go back to, look, that's a soda can. and it's pointless most of the time too. It's like, no one's like trying to like hurt somebody. It's just, we can't agree on basics. And how do we get anywhere that we need to get that's more advanced and more meaningful if we can't simply agree you're holding a fucking soda can in your hand? That's where it's, I don't know that we've advanced from it more or really have made no movement at all other than just, it spreads faster and wider and quicker than ever before. I don't know. It's there's one more chapter to this story as far as what history looks back on with the Hindenburg and what facts tell us of what actually caught the blimp on fire. And we're going to talk about that in the final chapter of this episode. If you want to hear that, become a Darksider. Sign up to do that. Go to patreon.com and search Darkside of Wikipedia, or go to darksideofwiki.com and click Become a Darksider. You'll get access to our final chapter of this episode, as well as our other episodes, access to our full archive of all of our episodes, all of them commercial free. You also get advanced episodes of the show, bunches and bunches of them, months and months of episodes just waiting for you to binge away on before the release to the public. Parts one, part two, the final chapter, all there for you up there on our Patreon site to support the show and keep us on the air. $5 a month to get all that. Again, patreon.com, search Dark Side of Wikipedia and help keep us on the air. For Sean, I am Tony. We'll see you in the final chapter of The Dark Side of Wikipedia.